Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinnemann, Director of Analytics and Review with Jurnov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you want to download it to your computer or your iPod. Today, we have a very interesting show as we step into the bowels of a project, into the war room itself. And I've always wanted to do a show with a contract attorney to talk about how these shows evolve from their perspective. And because contract attorneys are easily the most vulnerable people on the project, we're gonna refer to our contract attorney as Philip, which is a changed name, and I don't think we've changed your voice, Philip, or we're not that high tech here, but
it's early in the morning though, so it's a little bit deeper.
Okay, that's good. And the goal here is to really just talk through what works, what could be done better, and those types of things, and try to offer something constructively to improve these projects. And given my background, starting as someone that owned an agency that staffed 200 attorney projects, I've always wanted to do this show. So, Philip, thanks for coming on the show. And first of all, how did you become interested in electronic discovery, or a different way of asking this is, why did you decide to become a contract attorney on e-discovery projects?
Well, I think I got into it like a number of people, at least the ones that I've been on projects with, which is that, I did the typical first-year associate, 90-hour work weeks, weekends, spent in the office, missing friends' birthdays and nights outs and things like that. And so I wanted sort of a change of pace, so I actually moved across country to Los Angeles in 2005. And like a lot of people, I think, that become contract attorneys, I sort of wanted to focus on opening my own business and as a means to a paycheck, sort of stumbled into contract attorney work. And, it's not something you take home at night with you, so it worked for me in that sense. And, again, it paid the bills. So that's just sort of how I got into it, was purely by happenstance. I had my law degree and my bar membership and moved across country and found this opportunity where I could, earn a paycheck and not really have to take it home with me at night and could focus on my other business ventures.
Sounds good. And, obviously we're dealing with a sample of projects that you've been on when we talk about this, and maybe to some extent projects I've seen. But how many projects have you been on?
At last count, including the ones that I've been the project manager on, I've been on about 11.
Okay, that's a good sample. Although not random, it's still a sample. So you've been doing this since 2005, and in terms of how you've gotten in on these projects, have you worked for a single agency or a range of agencies, or on your own?
I've sort of run the gamut. I was fortunate enough to find an agency when I first moved to Los Angeles in 2005 that I sort of clicked with, if you will, and I like to think I did good work for them, and they got a good review and response from the managing attorneys on those projects and continued to hire me and put me on new projects. So I would say that probably 90% of my – apologize, there's apparently a fire in downtown L.A.
Yes, if you smell smoke, we can stop this and do this later. I always want my guests to be safe on the show. That's paramount. That's more important than the material. But anyway, continue on.
So I'd say probably 90% of what I've done has been through a single agency, the other 10% through a smattering of other agencies, and then on my own as well.
And you'd mentioned at the beginning that you've had a leadership role on projects. How did the leadership role or roles come about?
Well, I think that originally when I got into this, it sort of was something that came naturally to me. And whether it was sort of the fact that I tend to geek out on technological things, and so the software I picked up really well and sort of easily, and I like to think that I get along with people, and the agency sort of noticed that in me, and then called me for a project and said, hey, you know, we'd like for you to sort of take the reins on this one and run it for us, sort of be our eyes and ears on the ground, as well as the firm's eyes and ears on the ground. So that's originally how I got into my very first sort of project management role, if you will, and then ultimately, about 3 years ago, moved into a law firm and headed up their e-discovery practice group there as project manager. So that's sort of how I got involved in the leadership roles, if you will.
Well, let's talk generally about managing these projects from within the trenches there. What are some of the things you've seen that you thought worked well?
You know, I think what I've noticed across the board from way back in when I was the lowest man on the totem pole to managing them myself is really to give your document reviewers, your contract attorneys, A, respect, and B, as much information as you can give them. And you know, I'll give you an example. I've been on a case where I literally was given a 30-minute overview and a list of key words to look for. I think there were like 10. And they said, okay, here you go. And they set me down at a computer and basically said, start reviewing these documents. No case name, no complaint, you know, no requests for documents, no background whatsoever on the case. Just here's 8 terms. Look for any documents that have these and mark them responsive.
An empowering position, huh?
Exactly. So there's no empowerment. There's no motivation. There's no, you know, incentive. There's no sort of team. And I wasn't the only one, I should say. It wasn't like I was the sole reviewer. There were, I think, about 10 of us on that project. So I think for me, the biggest key is to really give your review team as much information as possible, you know, and I've seen that just work across the board.
Okay. So that's what can work, and, you know, I was going to look at what can't work well, and I suppose that could be an answer for that. We can just talk generally and randomly.
Sure.
if there's some things that pop in your mind about things that didn't work so well.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the inverse holds true, which is, you know, just sitting people down and telling them to go is obviously not an effective use of the attorney's time. And I think that sort of leads me into the next point, which is not treating attorneys like attorneys. I think a lot of times people get into these positions where they have, you know, 30, 40 contract attorneys on a project, and obviously they have other, you know, cases and limitations on their time. And so, you know, they really don't put in the time necessary to work with the contract attorneys. And I think FaceTime is a really big deal. Especially when you're working remotely, you know, again, I go back to, I've been on projects where I heard from the, you know, supervising attorney at the beginning of the case and worked for 3-6 months and, you know, maybe got one email from them, which was, you guys need to do more documents, basically. And I think that, you know, is frustrating.
A lot of this is sort of touchy-feely stuff, which isn't anything that lawyers and law firms have driven, you know, gotten rave reviews on, you know, traditionally, even without projects.
You're correct, and I think there's sort of a, you know, I'm a big proponent that the biggest skill that a project manager can have is simply being a people person. And I think that's the most effective route to an efficient document review. You know, really motivate the contract attorneys, you know, spend your time wisely, you know, sort of get inside their head, if you will, and figure out what motivates them, because each one is different.
Do you think part of it might be that, I mean, an associate that comes in at a firm might go through summer associate training, or they might, you know, they have a certain set of they get some cultural training within the firm on what's expected and how you behave. But when you're parachuted in, you basically have a project, right? So do you think it it might make even more sense to give deference to the people side for people like that for that reason, or is it just
absolutely
out,
I've seen that. I've worked at the largest firms nationally, and I've seen those first year associates sort of come in, you know, and sort of be overwhelmed with the scale and the volume and the time constraints, that are associated with these really large document reviews. And so I definitely think that, you know, it is not something that's traditionally looked at with much emphasis by firms, you know, which is this sort of touchy-feely, let's all get together and sing songs. But I do think that there is certainly a need for the focus to sort of be shifted back to that, especially in these really large-scale ones.
Is too much time spent talking about room layout, you know, windows, adequate, you know, ample workspace? What's your sort of sense in physical layout of the space? How important is that, marginally, extremely, or I guess does it depend?
You know, it's interesting because I've sort of seen the gambit, if you will, of everything from being, you know, stashed in the basement with boxes of documents around me and making makeshift desk to
no security and no exits for fires.
Exactly. To being on the, 42nd floor of a building with a nice window and maybe three or four other attorneys in the room and everything in between. And it does have a psychological impact. You know, everyone I've talked to across the board says that helps them, you know, having a window, you know, not being eight people to a closet does affect the work that you put out.
Well, let's talk about the psychology within a review room, because that's a different experience from what many attorneys have experienced before. So,
sure.
You know, if you want to sort of provide some descriptions of what goes through your mind as a sample of one, and also talking to other people that are in the room.
Sure. I mean, I think it's important again for people to realize sort of the background of the contract attorneys. I mean, you've got, you know, mothers who, you know, maybe are on maternity leave, who are doing this, you know, as an extra paycheck to make ends meet, to especially out here in Los Angeles, you know, people who want to be actors and screenplay writers who are doing this to earn a paycheck, but really are focused on other areas of their lives, to people certainly in this economy who have been laid off and are, again, doing this because, you know, they have a law degree and they can earn a paycheck. So I think you have to really understand the dynamics of the group. I think at the end of the day, though, they're all attorneys, and they share that sort of common bond and that, you know, work ethic, if you will. And, you know, there's a lot of tension, especially when you're up against deadlines, and there's, you know, drama does play out. I'm not, you know, especially when you're, you know, working 12, 14 hours a day with seven other people in a room. You get to know people really well, but, you know, you also, have space issues and people can get on each other's nerves, just like in any, you know, closed environment. It's not unlike an airplane, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So.
Well, in terms of managing, you know, the actual room, do you think it makes a difference to have contractors sort of manage themselves with a senior contractor? Or having a person actually from the firm, or is it just having someone who's willing to give the time to get to know the people? I mean, is that the key element?
I think the latter is the key element. I mean, you know, from my own experience, you know, having been on both sides of the equation, it was important for me once I got into the management role to really sort of meet the needs of my contract attorneys. And that sounds, again, that gets back to sort of the touchy-feely, but, you know, if you have a contract attorney who needs to take 4 hours and go run errands, you know, that's different from your traditional, you know, attorney that's at a firm role. And we have that ability to say, you know what, go take care of your errands, you know, doctor's appointments, you know, paying bills, whatever. And because you can come back and work, you know, your 4 hours at night. So I think there is a real opportunity to motivate your contract attorneys, you know, in ways that sort of the traditional firm really doesn't understand.
Now, you do see inappropriate behavior when you take a group of people that haven't known each other before and you say, I'm going to pay you for the length of this project, share the space. I mean, in an ideal world, everyone's professional and you just start working. But the reality is you're going to see inappropriate behavior when you take people don't know each other and put them together. One of the things I've seen on the projects that I've been involved in and frustration is the inability of the manager sometimes to get rid of people or to crack
sure.
a whip. Do you think having the project manager have the ability to quickly make HR decisions is a good idea, or should there be some type of a procedure like you have with a typical organization with an HR department and HR files, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually been in that position. You know, started out as a project manager. We brought in 18 contract attorneys, actually 19, 18 because of this one person. We noticed that the first week of the project, this person was taking 3-4 hour long lunch breaks. Well, after that billing cycle, we went back and looked at her records, and she was billing for, you know, essentially all of that time. So it was a real simple situation for us. You weren't at your desk, and, you know, we had her entry cards, which, you know, showed that she wasn't there. And so it was a real simple situation for us. You were billing time that you weren't there. And so we just called the agency and said, you know, this person is billed inappropriately and is not really working out. And it was as simple as that. And it was a done deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was effective, efficient, you know. There was no need to keep that person on when they clearly weren't working out.
Yep.
So I think that's a good example of where speed and efficiency to resolve a situation really is a bonus of the sort of contract attorney structure.
And what do you suppose would have happened if that person had been allowed to stay on the project to the rest of the team?
Well, I can tell you that we quickly thereafter, performed a quality control review of the documents that person had reviewed, and the work product simply wasn't there. And I think, too, you know, obviously from a psychological standpoint, the team sees this person constantly leaving and not really putting in the time. And, you know, the person next to them is sitting there, you know, 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day and really putting forth the effort, turning out good work product. And, you know, that has to be demoralizing. And that's one of the things that we try to prevent, obviously.
Well, let's talk about how you eventually were hired on one of your projects to join a firm as an associate. How did that occur?
Sure. You know, I'd been doing the contract attorney work, and the firm that I eventually joined had some really large, complex litigation in place and had been sold on a certain type of software. Without really any, you know, shall we say, substantive learning. And so they had a steep learning curve in place. And so I came in, and because I had extensive experience with the particular software, was really able to, you know, put some measures in place to help the efficiency and guide the reviewers. I think they actually had about 4 reviewers in place when I came on board. And then, you know, just really sort of educate the senior attorneys on the project, because a lot of these attorneys came from a traditional transactional background. So a lot of my job was really spent educating, which was, fun for me because that's sort of what I enjoy about it most. But
this goes way off topic to some extent, but you know, getting a job after having done this work, was that a I'm presuming this is an obvious question, but a positive outcome, right?
It was, and you know, again, I go back to how I originally got involved in it. It was because I really didn't, foresee myself long-term in eDiscovery. I had these other sort of grand ambitions. Once I got into eDiscovery, I realized that it's sort of, I do well at it, and it's something I enjoy, and over the years I've become passionate about, and the project management stuff, and,
attorney
work, and...
I'm going to share something of my background. I don't talk very much on these shows. I just throw questions up. I draft them. But I like to say I like the orchestra leader. There's an impact.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
But I have personal experience in this area, and I was a contract attorney before I started my staffing company, and I billed 3,000 hours the first year. I was the top billing associate in the firm I was at, and they saw that and they hired me. And for the life of me, I have never understood. Now, it was 91. We were in the midst of a recession, not a depression, a recession like we've seen recently, but it was still very bad. And
sure.
I was a Carnegie Mellon MBA with law review credentials. The attorney next to me went to the University of Notre Dame, a very good law school. It just was a tough market to break into. And I thought that it was a fair deal. I worked very hard. But the firm saw that and hired me, and there's a benefit to not throwing large salaries right out the door at top draft picks, essentially the cream of the crop, and looking at the reality of a work experience and seeing who you think practical common sense can get along with people, and the smarts maybe to spot things.
Absolutely, and I would only add to that I've certainly seen the attorneys on these projects who could move into the firm and be valuable, productive members of the firm immediately. They're really good people out there, and I do believe that there is some value, untapped potential, if you will, for law firms to really give these contract attorneys, a second look, if you will.
Let me be even bolder on this point. I recently gave a presentation for a local American Corporate Counsel Association here in Pittsburgh, and did a study of what was happening nationally managing outside counsel. A significant number of companies nationally are putting limits on what level of associate they will have on a project that they will accept billings from. Okay. Now, if you're a law firm and you make the point that you are hiring 20% of your associates out of pools of attorneys that you've vetted for work performance and mentored in war rooms, I mean, isn't that getting at the issue that, that the outside counsel is getting at, which is, these are people who came through the door with great credentials, but they're not trained yet. So contract attorneys make less than your typical associate. There seems to me like there's room for this, and outside counsel would actually appreciate hearing this. It might not push so hard. I'm just throwing an idea out there. I'm an entrepreneur also, but
I think there is great value in contract attorneys, and I think, we're both sort of speaking to this idea that perhaps there's this really untapped resource, or not untapped, but underutilized resource in contract attorneys.
Yep. Well, let's go back into the war room in terms of managing and just sort of to close out that area. Do you really believe that actually actively rolling up the sleeves, training, looking at performance and metrics and managing a review can make a difference in the case?
Absolutely, 100%. I've been on projects where you're completely unmotivated, you know, you're overworked, underpaid, unmotivated, unappreciated, and, you know, people sometimes forget you're looking at, you know, several hundred documents a day, few hundred, even in maybe an hour, depending on the type of document. It's very easy to miss something. And so, you know, I've been on projects where they say, you know, no internet, you know, don't check your email, you know, don't surf the internet. Well, that's fine and good, and I understand why that restriction is put in place, but I also know that if you look at 100 documents in an hour without any type of break or even taking your eyes literally off the screen, the chances of you missing something important, you know, go up exponentially, at least in my opinion. You know, that's sort of obviously not scientific, but that's just what I've experienced. And
I spent a lot of time in the software coding field with startups in Pittsburgh. It's sort of I help nurture startups in the evening as a hobby. And, you know, the technology field is known for putting in foosball tables and all these things that a lot of people don't understand. Why would you have that in the workplace? Until you actually watch how coding is done. And it's very, very mind-numbingly requires detailed attention on little lines of code. And you can't do this forever. You know, you need to take a break. And I
Absolutely.
Think the law projects are very similar in that regard. So these are good points.
Yeah, and I think you hit on something that, you know, these staffing agencies and firms would do well to investigate, which is sort of taking the Google approach, if you will, of having, you know, an open mind to the physical space and to how the review is physically constructed. You know, I think they would do well to really investigate that.
We actually have a Wii room at our coding facility, but that's a whole other issue or a whole other thing. You know, 'cause you got to have a Wii policy, you know, on how to use the Wii. But now anyone that's seen these projects understands there's a whole range of types of tasks that can be done. There's special assignments for special witnesses that are coming up, privilege reviews, production teams. Is there any type of hierarchy within the review team to address these types of tasks?
You know, I haven't seen, you know, anything on paper, if you will. I think, at least from my experience, you get a sense of your type A personalities and your overachievers and, you know, your sort of I'm here to collect a paycheck types early on in a project. So you know who you can count on to sort of go the extra mile and who you can count on to just, you know, sit at the desk and get their meet their numbers, if you will. And I think that's typically sort of how this works. You know, like from my experience, I had a gentleman on a project who literally took my 20-page memo to the group and put that into key terms and distributed that among the group so that they could tape it to the sides of their computers so that they wouldn't have to, you know, constantly look back to their manual and flip through pages and things like that. And to me, that showed a lot of forethought and you know, it's just hard work on his part. And so I knew I could count on this individual and ultimately said to this person, you know, would you be interested in, you know, we've got to get this privilege review out and then privlog and, and so that person, you know, took the reins on that and really took that, alleviated that stress from me. And so I think you get a lot of that in reviews where you sort of see the people you can count on and then you give them the special projects.
The reason I think that's important is, I'm a big fan of taking pages from other industries, okay, is when you it gives people bullet points to put on their resume of what they actually did in a project, and it differentiates people that have stepped up and gone the extra mile because they've actually gotten extra skill sets and experiences.
Sure.
And if they
Absolutely.
Can go on an interview and say, you know, we had 25 people, I was one of three people that ended up doing privilege review, well, that sort of gives them an advantage going forward. Kind of circling the loop, going back to what we said earlier about, you know, hiring and looking for talent off these projects. If you were to go to school to be an engineer, you would typically start working on contracting assignments right out of the gate for 3 or 4 years. And then eventually you'd build up enough experiences that someone would hire you. That's possibly the opportunity we can be offering to people in this rough market, is to give people the ability to get enough objective examples of accomplishment off these projects that you actually help them get a job down the line when the economy normalizes.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's any number of those that you can do. And, you know, that's a good point. I think I've sort of intuitively thought about that, never verbalizing it helped me to, you know, that's a really good point.
Well, let's talk about the end of the project. Well, let's talk about the false end of the project. Because in terms of communicating, and I'm a big fan of project management, have you ever seen a rumor of the project's ending because there's not enough work to keep people busy?
Only every project. Only every project.
And
it is sort of like the who gets voted off the island mentality. I mean, everybody's just sort of scrambling. It's an interesting dynamic.
So what happens, as projects winding down? I mean, tell me about that a little bit.
Well, I mean, you know, it can be as simple as, you know, noon rolls around and you get an email from the lead attorney that says, you know, take your lunch break. And by the way, the project's ended, which I have received early in my life as a contract attorney. The attorneys who are really upfront, you know, even from the beginning, say, you know, we expect the project to last 3 to 4 months. However, you know, it could go 6 months, and we'll sort of keep you posted at 3. And I think that's really beneficial, obviously, not only from the contract attorney's perspective, because they want to know, you know, when to expect sort of that last paycheck and maybe that gap in their income, you know, but also from the attorney's perspective, the managing attorney's perspective, because with morale dropping when the first inkling of, well, this project might be over, output drops significantly. And it doesn't drop because of the morale. It drops because they know that for every document they don't do now, it's another day, you know, added to the project. And, you know, so I've certainly seen, you know, the gambit of responses and ways that projects end.
I always thought, and I never, ever could do this on any of the projects that I started. I went in and preached it, that a retention bonus was a good way to address this. And the saying,
agree.
We're going to hold back 5% of, you know, and this is what you have to do. It's at our discretion, completely, unilaterally. We're the judge. There's no open-endedness about this. But if you work through the finish line and if you don't quit the project, we're going to give you 5% or whatever the number is, pick a number, to give you a bonus at the end of the project. And the reason for that is, that's when they're going to need it the most.
Exactly.
The buzz that would create about a firm or a place that worked, that, you know, you might have people hitting the finish line strong because working an extra day or two to stretch out a project would be a reason not to get the bonus. And
right. The
bonus
right. Over
3 or 4 months is going to be a lot greater than stretching a project out. It seems simple, but I don't know a lot of people that have done this.
It seems simple, and, you know, the law firms don't really utilize these new procedures and these new sort of creative thinking about how to motivate their review teams. And I think you hit on a great point with that, which is, how do we best motivate these individuals?
Yep, and deal with the problems they have, which are different from the problems you have in your firm.
Exactly.
Different
it's
culture.
A completely different beast.
I want to touch on one last area because I focus on this area now substantially. And, I mean, you've obviously worked with different software packages doing different projects. Do you find that there are differences between the software?
Absolutely. There's definitely a level of usability and obviously scalability, but just general usability that varies greatly between software. And you know, I think we're coming into a generation of users that pick this up, you know, more easily, if you will. And so you're not spending, you know, 3-4 days teaching them how to use the software. You might, you know, spend, you know, an hour at most. But there's definitely a wide range. And I've used probably, in my time, I probably used 5 or 6 different types of software. And I think that's probably pretty standard in LA, at least.
Yeah, I mean,
I've
there's
a
hundreds,
great deal.
Hundreds yeah. of packages that are out there. I can tell you just from, you know, the time I spend working on analytics and concept searching, et cetera, that it's getting much more complicated. The tools can do more, but they also have lots of risks associated if they're not done, if they're not managing workflow appropriately.
Absolutely.
I see your role becoming even more critical in this era, tell you the truth.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
absolutely.
It's the difference between driving and flying a Cessna or flying a 747 jumbo jet, because there's no easy button. There's just different levels of application within these tools that can make your life a lot easier if used correctly.
And when you use them correctly, you're right. It does help sort of, well, you know, one thing, it keeps you from being at the firm until 2 a.m. every night. I've certainly seen where it can get you in trouble as well. You know, you're relying on, you know, keywords to run your privilege search, so you maybe don't stress as hard to your contract attorneys to really be, you know, cognizant of reviewing for privilege. So it's a double-edged sword, and you still have to, you know, remain vigilant in that regard.
Okay, well, I think we've covered a lot of useful ground here, Philip. I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your insights, which are seldom discussed, but heck, it's 70% of the effort, according to a lot of people, spent on the staffing. You know, I think it's always a good use of time to be talking about these things. So thanks
Absolutely.
For coming on the show.
I appreciate the time spent with you. It's an honor to be on your show.
Great. To our listeners, thank you for listening to another edition of ESI Bytes. For a complete list of ESI Bytes shows, visit www.esibytes.com. And remember, we always say here, you should visit ESI Bytes to learn more about e-discovery before ESI Bytes you back. And I probably did this in the wrong order, but if you have trouble remembering ESI Bytes, just think of it as Easy Bytes, which is what my friend Jeff Reed said is a good way to remember the show. So that's about it. Thanks again, and look forward to doing more shows in the future with you, Philip, okay?
Thank you.